Okay, let's open our Bibles then again to that passage I just read. It's clear in our minds. Now we need the Lord to use it to speak to our hearts. So 2 Kings chapter 4, we're looking at that whole section from verse 8 through to verse 37. I'm conscious that having said this is a series on the life of Elisha, that actually many of the chapters and events featuring Elisha are as much about other people. And actually, ultimately, of course, they're about the Lord. So in this chapter, Elisha, of course, he has a significant part to play. But actually, in terms of the people involved, the focus is, I think, largely on this Shunammite woman. And so as we look at this passage tonight, you'll see from the outline, that's going to be our focus this evening particularly. We'll consider Elisha's part, of course, and ultimately, hopefully, have our attention drawn to the Lord. But I think we have a lot to learn from this Shunammite woman. I mean, it is amazing, isn't it, that here we are in Great Ellingham in 2022, and we've got things to learn from a lady who lived, 2,500 years ago in a little village of Shunem in Israel. She's got things to teach us about faith, about trust in the Lord, and about the Lord's goodness. We don't know her name. We don't know very much about her at all. But she's here in the Bible. And that means we need to look at her and learn from her this evening. So you'll see that we've got three headings tonight. We've got the example of a godly woman, and then the testing of a godly woman, and then the blessing of a godly woman. So let's just think about that this evening for a while. So first of all, the example of a godly woman, verses 8 to 13. We're in verse 8, we're introduced to this Shunammite woman. She's called that because she lives in the village of the town of Shunem, which is on the side of a hill, the hill called Moreh in northern part of Israel. Notice she's described as a notable woman, literally a great woman. That means she's a woman of some means. The wife of a fairly wealthy farmer. I mean, most farmers are wealthy, aren't they? Well, no, I'm not sure about this. But a lady of some distinction in the area. Well, there's a reminder to us. The Bible does warn us about the danger of riches or the danger of trusting in riches. But I think this woman is a reminder to us. It's possible to be wealthy and be godly at the same time. It's possible to have riches and use them well. And use them wisely. We're going to see that that's what this woman does. Of course, the trouble in our day and often in our lives is that we have plenty, and yet that causes us to live for the things of this life rather than trust in the Lord. Well, this woman's an example to us. Let's just think about, I've got three ways in which she's an example to us. She's an example in a desire for godly fellowship, okay? She's an example in a desire for godly fellowship. So we're told how Elisha came to Shunem. We're not told why, but it becomes clear later on that he often passes through Shunem on his travels. And we're told on this occasion, when he came to Shunem, that she, look at verse 8, persuaded him to eat food. Persuaded him to eat some food. Most of us don't need persuading to eat food. We need persuaded to not eat food, don't we? But this is a very strong word, okay? It means she constrained him. She pleaded with him to come back to her home and have a meal. And it's almost like she wouldn't take no for an answer. She's going to come. She wants this prophet to come, doesn't she? She wants to speak to him some more. Perhaps ask him some questions, listen to him, have his influence over her household. She wants him there. It reminds me, perhaps you young people remember this, of that occasion after Jesus has risen from the dead and he meets those two disciples on the Emmaus Road. Do you remember that occasion? And he speaks to them. They don't know who he is, do they? But they're thrilled. He's teaching them. He's talking to them. He's telling them about himself from the whole of the Bible. And their hearts are warmed, aren't they? And then they get to the point and Jesus is going to go on. And Luke says, they constrained him to come in. We want to know more. We want more of this. Okay, so here's a woman, well, I think we could say this, who loved fellowship with God's servant. with one of God's faithful people. After that initial occasion, look at verse 8, he often would pass by and he'd stop for a meal and fellowship. And so that fellowship and friendship with her and her husband would continue and grow. But then if you look on it in the chapter a bit further, it becomes clear that this desire for fellowship wasn't just when he came to her, but she would, I think we can imply that she went to Elisha as well. So look, when you get to verse 23, just look down to verse 23, when she informs her husband that she's going to go to the prophet, do you see how he replies in verse 23? Why are you going to him today? It's neither the new moon nor the Sabbath. So I think that's we can draw from that, can't we? That she did on those special occasions and on the Sabbath, she would go and spend time with Elisha. A lot of the commentators have drawn from that in these are idolatrous days, of course, aren't they? And departure from true religion, from the Lord. There were those who would still go and meet with the prophets in their house, perhaps, or somewhere, to hear the word of God, to meet with God, to have fellowship with God's people. I think this woman is one of those. She wants godly fellowship with God's people. I mean, that was a journey of 15 miles. You know, not in a car where, you know, the hardest thing you have to do is put your foot down on the accelerator. This is on a donkey in dusty conditions. But such is the desire for godly fellowship. To hear the word, to meet with the people of God, to have the influence of this, the word of God on her life. She's doing that. It reminds me, do you remember that last book of the Old Testament, the book of Malachi? You might want to turn there. It's quite easy to find, being the last book of the minor prophets. Malachi chapter 3, verse 16. It's one of those great 3:16s. Remember how Malachi, it's God, not very godly days. This departure from the truth. And then do you remember verse 16 of Malachi 3? Then those who feared the Lord spoke to one another. And the Lord listened and heard them. A book of remembrance was written before him for those who fear the Lord and who meditated on his name. So there's, in the midst of all of this, there's a group of people who meet together. They have fellowship together. They fear the Lord. They talk of the Lord. They talk of the Lord together. So that's a way in which this woman is an example to us. Desire for godly fellowship. We know that Christian fellowship, meeting with God's people, listening to his words, meeting together, talking together, eating together. It's just a privilege and it's a necessity, it's a vital necessity. Can you, young ones, know that example, don't you? If you take a coal out of the fire and put it on its own, while the fire coals, do that with a barbecue, or perhaps not at the moment, with it so dry, but you know, if you do that one, what will happen to that one on its own? It will go cold, won't it? And that's why we need fellowship. We need each other, don't we? We need to go, I need to be with God's people. I need to be under God's word. So she's an example in terms of a desire for godly fellowship. She's an example in her desire to show hospitality as well, isn't she? We have a wonderful picture here of hospitality. Firstly, her willingness, desire to provide food for God's servant, have an open table for him, presumably for his servant Gehazi as well, and then a willingness to open up a home to Elisha too, make this room all fitted out for him to use whenever he came through. It's not something she's forced to do. It's not something sort of Elisha puts himself on her and she feels obliged to do. She does it. She does it gladly. She does it willingly. Both my sets of grandparents and knew each other. That's how my mum and dad met, by Mr. Collier, the pastor at Linslade, would come and preach at Bradford-on-Avon. And that's, you know, he would bring his young son along with him sometimes, and my mum and dad, their eyes met and they fell in love, and that's how that happened. But there was, so he would come and he would always stay with my other set of grandparents. God, this is getting confusing now, isn't it? It gets even more confusing because they had a room in their house, my mum's parents, that was called Mr. Collier's room, they called it. They had children still in that room, but they would call it Mr. Collier's room because whenever Mr. Collier came, that was his room, and he could stay there, and he was welcome anytime. Mr. Collier's room, there it was. Well, this lady had a Mr. Elisha's room. where he would stay. Hospitality. Now, when we come to the New Testament, you see that's vital, isn't it? It's important. Showing hospitality. Welcoming people into your home. We know from 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 that that's one of the qualifications for eldership, isn't it? That we're hospitable. But we also know Romans 12 and 1 Peter, that's to be true of all of us, isn't it? As much as we're able to. As believers, we know that everything we are, everything we have, belongs to the Lord, including our homes. And they'll be used for the Lord, aren't they? So it's said, isn't it, an Englishman's house is his castle. Well, that shouldn't be the case for us as Christians. Our homes should be welcoming places. Places other believers are welcome. Places where good fellowship can be found, where the lonely can find a place to be. Hospitality. Now, sometimes we make the mistake of thinking, you've got to be a gourmet chef to show hospitality, that you've got to put on a massive spread. Now, some of us like doing that, but that's not part of it. If you've got two chairs and you can make a cup of tea, you can show hospitality, can't you? You can have somebody around. You can meet someone at the coffee shop and buy them a cup of coffee. I mean, that's sort of that same thing, isn't it? Anyway, she's an example of that. I think that's worth pointing out. She's also an example in her contentment with her lot. And that's verse 13. So we see from verse 11 that Elisha wants to repay this woman for her kindness in some way, for all that she's done for him. And so once when he's staying, he calls her in and asks her what he can do for her. And it's a funny thing that he offers. Perhaps you can explain it to me afterwards. But, Elisha, due to the previous events of chapter 3, remember, he's got the ear of kings now, hasn't he? And the commander of the army owes him a favor, really, because he certainly helped them out, didn't he? And do you want me to speak to you to the king, or get you an audience with the king? Or is there something you need done that... And does she have a complaint that she needs, it would be helpful for to get the king's help on or something like that? I mean, she may be a notable woman in the area, but she's obviously not known to the king, and Elisha could speak to her. But look at her reply anyway in verse 13. What does she say? She says there at the end of verse 13, look, I dwell among my own people, she says. And that's her way of saying, I'm happy as I am. I'm happy with my own people. She has the Lord's people. She has all that she needs. She doesn't need an introduction to the king or a word with the commander of the army. She's a woman who's content with a lot. Now, you might go, oh, well, of course she's content with a lot. She's a notable woman. She's the wife of a wealthy farmer. I mean, what's she got to be discontent about? But, of course, it would be foolish to say that, wouldn't it? Because money's never made anyone content, has it? It's never made anyone satisfied. There are plenty of people who are richer than this woman ever was and yet grumble and complain and would have plenty that they would want brought before the attention of a king. Now, it's not her riches that have made her content, is it? It's not her riches that make her say, I dwell with my own people. It's her godliness. Because what does 1 Timothy 6 tell us? Godliness with contentment is great gain, isn't it? There's only one thing that's going to make you truly content. And it's knowing God, isn't it? It's knowing your sins forgiven. It's having a relationship with the God who made you. That's the only thing that's going to make you content. Young people need to understand that, don't you? That is the only thing that's going to satisfy your heart. To know Jesus, to live your life for him, to walk with him, to know that you're one of his. You remember those wonderful words in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5. It was a favorite verse of dear Martha, who some of us remember, who lived in the cottage there. Hebrews 13, verse 5, let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said, I will never leave you or forsake you. So are we contented? Do we have a quiet spirit? Not always wishing we were different or had more? The example of a godly woman. Things to learn from this lady. Okay, secondly, the testing of a godly woman. That's verses 14 through to 28. So even if we were tempted to think that she ought to be content because she's got plenty, we would be missing something, wouldn't we, that would have made most 8th century Israelite women, 8th century BC Israelite women, very discontent. What is it? She hasn't got a son. She hasn't got an heir. And of course, in Old Testament Israel, that's a disaster. That's a major thing. No son to carry on the family name. No son to carry on take on the family inheritance, the family farm, or whatever it was. It was disastrous as far as a Jew was concerned. No child. So this woman doesn't have a son, and her husband's old. And so when she's gone, Gehazi just sort of reminds Elisha of that. So Elisha calls her back in, promises her, there it is, verse 16. She stands before him, verse 16, about this time next year, you shall embrace a son. Wow, I mean, she can't believe it, can she? I mean, though she's content, obviously that's been a sorrow to her, hasn't she? She's come to terms with the fact that it's not going to happen, perhaps. And now she doesn't want her hopes rekindled only to be dashed, does she? She's just, what does she say? She says there in verse 16, no, my Lord, man of God, do not lie to your maidservant. And yet, in the goodness of the Lord, she's given a son. A son is born to her the next year. She's not the first barren woman in the Bible, is she, to be promised a son and find the Lord faithful? I mean, the Old Testament's full of that, isn't it? Sarah, Abraham's wife. Hannah, the prophet Samuel's mum. Mrs. Manoah, Samson's mum. Come to the New Testament, Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist. And so here we are. And this child is born. And then it just says, doesn't it, in verse 18, look at verse 18. And a child grew. And we can imagine this son growing up, what it meant to his mum and to his dad, the delight of their eyes, joy it brought to them, gift from God. And then one day, suddenly, unexpectedly, he dies. Goes out to his father in the field, complains about his heads, he's taken home in his mother's arms, and he dies. The one whom the Lord has given is taken away. Well, we're reminded again, aren't we, of the mystery of God's ways. We so often don't know why God does. We often don't have explanations, do we, for why God does things. I think it's interesting to discover, isn't it, later on in the chapter, that the Lord has hidden this from Elisha. He doesn't have an explanation, does he? Verse 27, you remember, see what he says? The Lord has hidden it from me and hasn't told me. One of the commentators was saying, well, that's we've often got to say that, haven't we? We haven't got to have our, things. Strange things happen, strange providences happen in Christians' lives. And sometimes, even perhaps especially as a pastor, you feel you've got to have an answer. You've got to be able to explain it. And sometimes you just have to go, the Lord's hidden it from. I don't understand. I don't know. God's ways are higher than ours, aren't they? Well, how's this woman going to react? What's this going to do to her faith? Well, in the midst of her sorrow, I want to suggest that she displays great faith. How's it seen? Well, again, in three ways. It's seen in her laying her son on the bed of Elisha. Verse 21, that's what she does. She goes, she takes him, she lays him on the prophet's beds. I think that is faith fueled by what God has done in the past. Of course, normally in Middle East, plans for burials happen straight away. They'd be buried the same day before, in the heat, before everything decomposed. But this woman instead takes him and lays him in an upper room on the prophet's beds. Now, if we'd read 1 Kings before we read 2 Kings, we come to 1 Kings 17. Perhaps you younger ones again remember this story. Elijah, he's got a widow's son, and he does the same thing, doesn't he? Elijah takes that son and lays him on his bed. And then in a similar way. Praise and he's raised from the dead. Now, can you imagine? Here's this woman. Elisha comes and stays at house. And as they have fellowship together, I'm sure she says, "Oh, tell me about Elijah. Tell me some of the things that happened while he was..." And she would have heard this story. And so when her son dies, she remembers it. She goes and lays him on the prophet's bed. I think this is faith fueled by a reminder of what God has done in the past. That's why we need to know what God's done in the past. That's why we need to know the Bible. That's why we need to know our church history. Because very often those things remind us and fuel our faith. Our faith is seen in what she says to her husband as well. Verse 22 and 23, I suppose it's seen in what she doesn't say to her husband as well. It's remarkable that this thing has happened. Her son's died, and yet she keeps it from her husband and doesn't tell him. Now, I don't think that's a sort of an example to us of how marriages should work. But here it is. Why doesn't she tell him? Well, I think the answer lies in her response to her husband's words. So, verse 23, we've said this. Why are you going to him today? It's neither the new moon or the Sabbath. And she says, it is well. If you've got a margin in the New King James, you will have that. It will be well. I think the Authorized Version has it shall be well. So there is a definite future emphasis to it. Okay, all will be well. In other words, although she's just laid her dead son on the bed, she doesn't believe it's the end of the story. Okay, she believes the Lord's given her this son, and having done that, he's not going to take him away now. She believes that. She has faith even in the face of death. Now, of course, we understand this is a unique, remarkable miracle linked with this prophetic ministry of Elisha. And yet we have the same hope in the face of death if we're Christians, don't we? For all who are trusting in Jesus, it's not the end of the story. We can look into the grave and say, it will be well. Lois and I had the privilege of spending a bit of time with a Christian lady called Mandy. Some of us have been praying. We mentioned her on the prayer meeting. She's around our age. She's in a hospice on the brink of eternity. We were able to spend a bit of time with her on Monday. She was quite alert. And we were able to say to her, basically, it will be well. The best is yet to be. And she knew that. She believed that. She said it. That's faith speaking, isn't it? It will be well. Her faith is also seen in going to the man of God. Okay, so she rides 15 miles to Carmel. And when Elisha sees her coming, he sends Gehazi to ask if all's well. And this time, there's not that future. It shall be well. It is just well. It is well. So I think we can say her faith has been almost strengthened even more. This is present now. This is such is her faith, confidence in the Lord that she can say, even in the face of the circumstances, it's well. She knows she's in the Lord's hands. She knows she can trust him, trust her son to him. And so she says, it's well. It reminds me of that hymn we're going to finish with this evening. So I hope you've got some voice left. The hymn of Horatio Spafford. You know, when he's written after he's lost his business and lost his children in a storm at sea. And what does he write? When peace like a river tendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot has taught me to say, it is well. It's well with my soul. Can you say that? Can you say that tonight? No matter what comes, you have that faith in the Lord, it's well. The Lord's in control. The Lord's sovereign. Well, look back in our passage. This woman's not put off, is she? She runs straight past Gehazi and she falls at the feet of Elisha and grabs hold of him. When Gehazi thinks, well, this isn't really appropriate, and tries to push her away, she won't be thwarted. She must speak to Elisha, mustn't she? As the Lord's representative, and she pours out her heart to him. Did I ask for a son, my Lord? She said. Did I not say, do not deceive me? So that's faith, isn't it? There's anguish of heart. There's a questioning, but she's come to the prophet. And he's the Lord's representative. She's crying out to the Lord, isn't she? That's what faith does. She knows where to come. It's a sign of her faith, isn't it? Prayer is a sign of faith. In a sense, that's what she's doing. She's coming to the Lord's representative. And she's crying out to him. So we have the testing of a godly woman. And we see her faith. And it's a faith that's an example to us. Great faith, fueled by what God has done in the past, confident that all will be well in the future, knowing that all is well in the present. So do we have faith like that? Do we need to pray, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief tonight? What a difference it makes to our lives, doesn't it? To our testimonies, to our prayers, to have such faith. Okay, so we've got the example of a godly woman and the testing of a godly woman. And then lastly, the blessing of a godly woman. That's verse 29 to 37. So when Elisha realizes what's happened, he sends Gehazi on with his staff. Don't be sidetracked by anyone. Don't stop. Don't have a chat with anybody. Just on you go, and go and place this on the face of the child. Now, why? What's all that about? Truthful answer, I don't know, if you've got an idea. Well, the Bible doesn't always tell us, does it? It doesn't always explain everything to us. It doesn't always satisfy our curiosity. Perhaps it's just to sort of mark this child out as the Lord's. You know, not to be taken. Well, Elisha then hurries to the house, doesn't he? And shuts himself in the room with this child. Praise to the Lord, verse 33. I mean, that must have been something, wasn't it? What prayer time that must have been. Praise to the God of life and death. And then he stretches himself out on the child. Now Elijah had done that with the other child, hadn't he? And again, I don't understand really that. It's not resuscitation, is it? Because this child's been dead for hours by now. But it warms the body, but it doesn't bring it back to life. Elisha wanders around the house for a bit before doing the same again. And then came what must have been the most wonderful sounding sneezes in the history of sneezes. I mean, the world's been terrified of sneezes for the last 3 years, hasn't it? But here were seven sneezes that were a joy to the ears. Why seven? Answer, because it was one more than six and one less than eight. Now, if we were if this was Revelation, then I might start telling you, wow, seven's the perfect number, and we might get all excited about that. But I don't think we can read into it. Sneeze seven times. God had brought him back to life. And the godly Shunammite woman is told to pick up her son. Her son's returned to her. She worships. She falls down and bows to the ground, doesn't she? And then she picks up her son. Well, that must have been a wonderful moment, mustn't it? Now, that was a rare miracle, wasn't it? I mean, lots of mothers lost their child. Children died and they weren't brought back to life in the days of Elijah, in the days of Elisha. But this one was. How could that happen? Well, because of a greater prophet who would one day come. And actually, that greater prophet would one day come, interestingly, to a town not very far away from Shunem. Shunem was on a hill, on one side of a hill. On the other side of the hill was a town called Nain. Perhaps you young people remember that name? Nain. What happened at Nain? Well, one day, a greater prophet, Jesus, came to Nain. You remember what was coming out of Nain? A funeral party were coming out of Nain, weren't they? A widow, husband already died, now she's coming out with her son. Jesus stops them. He doesn't have to pray to God because he is God. He doesn't have to lie on the boy. He just, with absolute authority, what does he say? He says, young man, I say to you, arise. And that funeral was cancelled. And the widow received her son back again. And both of those occasions, again, are little glimpses, aren't they? Little reminders that there's a conqueror of death. There's someone who's stronger than death. And in Jesus, we have someone who's conquered death and enables us here this evening, if we trust in Jesus Christ, to be able to say in the face of death, it is well. And to actually give us a greater hope than was given to either of these women, because both those sons came back to life, but they came back to life, if you like, on the same side of the river of death, didn't they? They were going to have to die again. But we have a hope in Jesus Christ that we'll rise again on the other side of death. Never to die again. Resurrection, glory. All because of Jesus Christ. All because of the fact that he came and conquered death and rose again from the dead. Do you have that hope? We were thinking about hope this morning. Well, this is the hope, isn't it? Can you say it is well? If you were to be diagnosed with some terminal illness tomorrow, could you still say it is well? The best is yet to be. You can in Jesus, can't you? You can through coming to him and trusting him. He died that we might live. So let's learn from this woman. Let's rejoice with her. And one day, by God's grace, part of our hope is we'll meet her and meet Elisha. And we can ask him why he sent Gehazi to put the staff on the face of this boy.